everybody, and welcome to another edition of History After Hours. My name is Kevin Pumphrey, and with me, like normal, is Mr. Ron Franklin. But this is a special episode of the podcast in which we recorded on April 14th. We interviewed an up-and-coming scientist and my niece, Bethany Paxton, and we were able to talk with her a little bit about her background, how to get into research, a little bit into the vaccine controversy that erupted around COVID, and really the overall importance of listening to experts in certain fields. And so hopefully this is informative and useful. And with that, we hope you enjoy the podcast. Okay, we have a special edition of History After Hours. Me and Mr. Franklin are here like normal, but with us, joining us, all the way from Prattsville, Arkansas.
Beautiful downtown Prattsville, Arkansas.
That's right.
Okay, real quick, I know we're going to do other things, but for people who don't know where Prattsville is, like me, it's near Sheridan, yes? That's the biggest thing that I could sort of pinpoint.
It's in Arkansas for our international listeners. It's in the United States. Let's start there. And then in Arkansas, and then between Sheridan and Malvern. It's probably an easy way to locate our little village.
Okay, so I've been through there. I know I have been.
Yeah. Yeah. So my niece.
Science Mecca.
Science Mecca, apparently.
Yeah.
Okay. So Bethany Paxton, who I knew as Bethany Henderson for most of my life, she is joining us today, and the reason she's joining us is because, once again, she's my niece, and we started talking about things, and I really found them interesting, and she has a very interesting background in science, and so a lot of what we're going to talk about is going to probably be science-based. So first of all, welcome to our podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
If you don't mind, just give us a summary of your background and then how you got into what you've been into.
So I wasn't really interested in science until my junior year of high school, and in my AP biology class, my teacher taught us about how brain cells communicate to each other. It's called action potentials. And I remember being on the edge of my seat the entire class, and I hadn't really been interested in science up until that day. And then it was just like a switch was flipped.
So a high school teacher changed your life.
Yes.
See how
it can happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so then I, at the end of the class, I walked up to her. It was Karen Burnett at Sheridan. And I said, "Hey, Miss Burnett, I'm going to be a neurosurgeon." And she was like, "Okay, sweetie." Then I was planning on being a doctor because, you know, if you're interested in science, just med school is kind of the next thing generally. That was the only path that I knew. So then I went to college at Henderson in Arkadelphia, Arkansas, and I got a bachelor's in biology. And so while I did that, I didn't really know that. Like, I wasn't super interested in med school, but it was just the only thing that I thought I could do. And then I did some, I got involved in some research with some professors, and I was studying, what we were doing was we were taking soil samples in I had like a deer feeder set up. Sorry, this is like really.
I actually remember when this was going on.
Oh, you do?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, sorry.
You know, my mom.
True, she does.
Your life, so.
Yeah. So yeah, I had like a deer feeder set up on a protected land area. It's the Simonson Biological Field Station in Bismarck. That's where I did this, and had a deer feeder set up with some corn in it, and then I had cameras, and so I would record what animals came there, and then I would take samples of the soil and then figure out what DNA was in the soil and try to link it back to whatever animals were there. So this would eventually...
Did this start off as like a chronic wasting disease kind of experiment, or was it always about DNA?
It was just more of a like conservation, like ecology experiment to see if it would be a more efficient way of figuring out what animals were in the area, and it didn't work because I only had about a year to do it, and we really didn't get anything significant. I think we had... At one point on my cameras, I had an entire family of raccoons just holding on to it, falling, rolling in the dirt, and I did not get a single piece of raccoon DNA in my samples. So
I heard, and we'll I don't see. Know if this is right or not, but that scientists are using soil sampled DNA to trace back evolutionary animals that are extinct. And they can say, well, in this area, we know these animals existed because we can find remnants of their DNA in the soil. Is that, did I hear that right? Are you familiar with that?
Possibly.
Or is it, it would be similar to what you're talking about though, right?
Yes. So that would be through DNA sequencing.
Okay.
So yes, evolution is tracked through the sequence of the DNA because evolution comes from, it starts as random changes in the DNA, which are from mutations. And so you can just kind of track that through time and see what
But
changed.
It lasts in the environment for how long?
Ooh, DNA is super stable. I think it lasts a long time.
Especially maybe in a permafrost sort of area.
Yeah, that's actually a current concern because as that is thawing, there are some ancient viruses that we don't have any immunity to that could possibly be.
Yeah, we've talked about that before. I've heard about that. And that is
Yeah, okay. So I didn't mean to sidetrack.
No, that's okay. Those are just things I've like heard of, but and I'm like, okay, yeah, that makes sense to me.
I had never heard of soil sampling for DNA though, so I thought that was kind of neat.
Yeah, so you know, if they fall, like if a raccoon falls in the dirt and they roll around, you know, they have some hair cells and skin cells that have DNA in them, and so then that just kind of gets in the DNA, or sorry, in the soil. And so then I can take. There's just like a kit that I bought. It's not super complicated, and you just follow the instructions, and you just mix this chemical with it, and then you mix this chemical and this chemical, and then you like heat it up. And it's a really complicated experiment. But then you get this DNA and then you just send it to another company that sequences it and then they send you the data back. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mostly what I found was a lot of bacterial DNA because there's a lot of bacteria in the dirt and there's bacteria on the raccoons and on the birds and everything.
No Ebola or anything like that?
No.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's good.
But this changed your trajectory from being a medical surgeon.
Yes. Yeah, I didn't know, you know, I was like, well, I don't really want to do med school because I didn't really, I shadowed a few times and I wasn't super interested in it, but I loved learning and talking to those professors at Henderson. It was Drs. Tommy Finley and Troy Bray. They were absolutely wonderful people. And they kind of saw that I had this spark for learning and especially like also working with my hands because that was really fun to do. And yeah, they started talking to me about graduate school and doing research and eventually getting a PhD. And they, because I told them my med school plans and they were like, no, I don't see you in med school. I see you enjoying research more. And so they were the ones that kind of steered me.
How hard is it to get employed in a research capacity? That's for people who might be interested in following that same path. Do you know, is that, or you just strike it on your own? Is that, how does that work?
For me,
or their facilities, I would assume. Yeah. Research companies
like biotech.
Well, I don't know. That's what I'm asking. Yeah.
So typically the way, like if you want to do research, so the type of research I do is like biochemistry and molecular biology. So molecular biology is just studying DNA and RNA and proteins, which are molecules. And so you can apply that to pretty much anything. My lab mostly focuses on a few proteins involved in cancer research, but other labs study cholesterol, and you can just kind of study like the structure of any type of molecule, and it has some roles in most diseases. So and then you can do chemistry, which is a little bit more difficult in my opinion. But yeah, if you want to get involved in research, typically.
So for kids that like biology, this is definitely a potential career path.
Yeah. So you would want to do typically a bachelor's degree in like biology, biochemistry, chemistry. And then while you're doing that, you can get involved in research at your college. Oh, and you can also get involved while you're in high school. We have a couple high school students working with us, but they're from the math and science school here in Hot Springs. But I think there are internships as high school students that you can get, and UAMS has a few.
Cool.
So then you can work in a real lab and get real experience and figure out what it's like. And typically they're paid opportunities. So yeah, that's how I got into UAMS. So I did a little bit of research at Henderson and then I got a summer internship at UAMS working in Dr. Robert Oaf's lab. And I loved that. And that's when I did CRISPR. That was my first experiment, which was crazy. And yeah, so now I'm back in his lab working as a research tech.
So looking at the video stuff that you had sent to us a little bit ahead of time, you talked a lot about the COVID research and the vaccines, and that's still big topics for us, having come through, trying to teach through the pandemic, and then watching all the different people's reactions to it. And so I wondered if Like, how did you get tracked down that path specifically?
Okay, yeah, that's a great question. So I was interested in science up until that point, and I was really starting to, you know, I decided I was going to go to grad school, so I felt like I was on the right path, and I was really interested in science, and then I started listening to some science podcasts, and I didn't really, you know, I don't study viruses, but I have taken a class on them, so I know the basics, but I didn't really see the importance of me learning about it and communicating it until December 2020, and the vaccines were announced that they were going to start giving them to,
like, elderly first, right?
Yeah.
I remember, yeah.
Yeah, they came out in phases, I remember.
Yeah, so the first group of people they were going to give is immunocompromised. Or
right,
like,
oh yeah,
people.
Most vulnerable.
Vulnerable right. people, yeah. And I got on Facebook, and a lot of the people in my community, including some nurses and healthcare people, were talking about they're not going to take it, it's dangerous. And I was like, okay, I need to do something about this. But I didn't understand it at that point either. So I took my finals, because I think that was like the first week of December. I took finals, and then I had that entire winter break. I didn't have any plans. So I was like, let me just learn about this virus and what it is. So I spent a month learning about it, and then I made the YouTube series. And I realized from talking to my grandparents, they didn't learn about cells or DNA or RNA, and I think that was the problem, partially because some people were watching the news and they were hearing these words over and over, and then they convinced themselves that they understand, like, what right. DNA is or RNA is, mm-hmm. how the vaccine works, and then they can just say, oh,
it's odd that healthcare workers were amongst those who were downplaying it or were even criticizing,
yeah,
or even worse, I think, instructing people not to take it.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder, where did that come from? I wonder. I mean, I don't know.
Well, I think, I mean, also healthcare workers, that's a broad term.
Yes.
Like, so when you're talking about nurses, or you're talking about, like, what is their understanding of RNA and DNA and vaccines? You know,
it's but someone who, but my point is that if you work with inside the healthcare professional, you're trying to work to keep people healthy. You right. do know that vaccines are regulated and they work.
And they work.
So mm-hmm. to see right. people saying, oh, I don't know, or you should be afraid of this, or you should take this horse tranquilizer or whatever the hell it was.
Yeah, do you have an opinion on that?
What was that?
Why even healthcare workers who really would benefit from people taking the vaccine or being, you know.
It just seems like they would be the ones who would know better first. Instead of being part of the problem.
Theory on that?
Yeah, this might be a little controversial, but
well, we can always take it.
We don't shy away from that.
So I just think that getting the bachelor's degree, it did not click for me until my third and fourth years, because I think it's partially because of the way that you learn science, but the first 2 years are not really molecular based. The first 2 years are just like anatomy and physiology, general chemistry. They don't have to take any advanced or like non-doctors, basically. If you don't have a bachelor's degree, you do not have to take any of the more difficult classes. And the more difficult classes generally are more biochemistry based. So you're looking at, how does DNA work? How does RNA work? What makes two proteins bind to each other? And that's what my job is. So I really understand very well how the mRNA vaccines work. And I understand how mRNA works in the body. I think there's this, it's just like, you're just in between. Like, some people, if they have some education in healthcare, but they think they know what they're talking about.
And just enough to be dangerous.
Yes. Yeah. But they don't know enough to know that they don't know what they're talking
about.
That
makes sense. I mean, I mean, we see that in the teaching profession too, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's where that phrase comes, you know, just enough to be dangerous, which means you don't know what you don't know. But you think you know, and that's the biggest thing, mm-hmm. is you're saying stuff with confidence that sounds smart to a lot of people.
Yeah.
But in reality, you're giving them bad information because mm-hmm. you don't know enough.
Yeah, the other side of that too is that if you have gone through any schooling that leads you towards a healthcare profession, or let's just say profession, then you would think that they would err on the side of caution and promote what scientists and health organizations on a federal or international level were saying, as opposed to saying, instead of falling into the trap of local propaganda and going, I don't know, drunk Bobby on Twitter said, And I don't think I'm going to listen to anybody else but him. Like, that's yeah. weird to me. The whole story is bizarre, right? When you look back on it mm-hmm. and how many people went in so many different directions. You had predicted years before that a pandemic might bring us together. This obviously
one of the few mm-hmm. things I thought could solve polarization. Looking back, it made everything worse.
Yeah.
And look, I think the medical community, especially the messaging, was also not great. Because they yes. made a lot of early mistakes saying things out of turn that came back to be false, which started to embed distrust, and it gave people a little ammunition against them. You know, like, I mean, the whole mass situation went back and forth, and that's coming mm-hmm. from the medical community. Mm-hmm. Also, it was like the messaging was either you take the vaccine or else, and they didn't give you anything else because some people can't take these vaccines. Like, not everyone has the biology because there's some people that just can't take vaccines.
Yeah, but it seems like that would be so few people in the big scheme of things that it would, I'm not saying it's negligible, but at the same time, it wouldn't be
true.
So many people that you would be like, the majority of Americans would go, well, I don't know.
But even there was zero messaging of natural ways to boost your immunity, which would help.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we talked about that a little bit too. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I also, of course, coming back to your expertise is all we have are experts to tell us what's what. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not an expert really in anything. I mean, even stuff that I say that might sound smart, I didn't do the research. I didn't write the books. I didn't do the studies. I wasn't in a lab trying to figure out stuff. Even as a history teacher, I wasn't writing books. I wasn't comparing primary sources to figure out what Churchill really said in the back mm-hmm. room with a cigar. So, like, I'm just echoing what other historians say. And that's what most people, and so, like, this kind of brings up what we've been talking about. What exactly are you trained to do so far, and what's your trajectory in this?
Oh, that's a good question. So right now I feel like I'm just trained to learn and just optimize experiments. And I mean, whenever I'm in the lab, I am just trying to do an experiment to test something. And then a lot of times it won't work. And so I have to go back and be like, okay, what step did I mess up on? Because it's probably me. I've repeated some experiments like 15 times and they take like 2 weeks long. So that's really fun.
But your trajectory, mm-hmm. like so what you're specifically studying and what is the end goal as far as, like, I guess you're pursuing your PhD now.
So I'm a research technician now and I'm planning to start my PhD probably next fall. But it's kind of the same. Like I think people get confused with like a PhD school. They're like, oh, you're in a classroom. Mm-hmm. Most of it is just research. So right now I am contributing to my PhD project if I stay in my current lab. Mm-hmm. So all the experiments I'm doing right now will eventually become part of my dissertation.
Right. So it's all heading for the same direction. And what specifically yes. is your title? I mean, what subject matter are you specifically studying?
A PhD in molecular biology?
Yes. Okay. So if you want to get more specific, I am studying, or my lab, so the OAF lab at UAMS, studies it's called a secondary DNA structure. Do you understand what DNA is first?
I've heard of DNA. Mostly, yeah.
Okay. So like in a cell, you know, DNA is like the instruction book for that cell, like how to be a cell, how to respond to a dangerous environment or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it has like an instruction. It's like a blueprint manual for all these tools that the cell can use. And the tools that blueprint codes for are called proteins. And so RNA is kind of like an in-between step of those. So you go DNA, which makes RNA, which makes proteins. So a lot of people don't know that. So I just wanted to get that clear.
For sure.
I've heard those words.
Yeah. So
double
study.
Helix and whatnot.
Yeah, double helix DNA. And so I study, or our lab studies, something called a G quadruplex. So just G4 for quadruplex. And that is an area of the DNA that's like tangled, basically. It's a good way to think about it. So, you know, DNA is like this twisted double helix ladder kind of thing. And then if you imagine part of it just sections off and just like gets tangled up instead of binding to the other part of it. Does mm-hmm. that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And so these are really important. The thing
is that an abnormality, or do all DNA strands have that?
All of them have that. That's one of the most interesting things about G quadruplexes to me, is their structure is built into the DNA sequence. So that means...
So it's wrong on purpose.
Well, the structure's there on purpose. It's not wrong. It's very necessary.
That makes more sense. Because it's not an abnormality. It's meant to be there.
Yeah.
But why isn't it structured like the rest of it then? What is it? What's the functionality of the tangling?
Yeah. So the functionality is to, it controls which genes are read. So it's normal. Like there are
like
a lot
filter?
Of them. It's kind of like an on-off switch.
Okay.
We're talking about genes on being off. This is what they're.
This is one thing that can do
regulates
that.
Regulates that.
Okay.
The tangle controls the on-off switches.
It can. Yes.
Okay.
And so we study the proteins that untangle those knots.
Oh, okay.
So yeah. Whoa. And that's like, oh, cool. That doesn't mean anything.
Okay. So
but,
potentially though, studying DNA and these specific things that can turn genes on and off. I mean, potentially, this is everything. This is every biological thing that happens with a human is embedded in this.
Do you guys study the reasoning that certain things get turned on and off at certain times? Or is that part of it? Or is that even understandable at this time?
Yeah, it's understandable.
Okay.
We just focus more on the mechanism of how the tangles are untangled and like under what context.
Mm-hmm. Are there environmental issues that cause the things to switch or how does it react to, like, what is it reacting to? Do you know when it might turn something on or off? That may be a relevant question.
I guess we don't really study that. We study more of just like how they're,
it is happening.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Also, I've only been doing this for like a year, so it's not, I still don't know everything.
Yeah,
it's
sure.
Very
well,
frustrating.
Yeah.
But yeah, so there's probably an answer to your question. I just don't know it, or I can't think of it right now. But
we'll have you back on in a few years and we'll expect an answer.
This is just our innate
curiosity.
Remember
that question?
Yeah.
Yeah, we can barely spell DNA. So.
Yeah.
Can you spell it backwards?
So one importance of these G-quadruplexes or G4s is that there are about 1,000 times more of them in cancerous tissue than non-cancerous tissue.
Okay. 1,000 times more of them. Okay.
Yes.
So here's where we're getting to. When people talk about curing diseases of just about any type, the work you're doing will, if it happens, it will contribute to this understanding. Like,
hopefully.
Cancer, any kind of genetic disease, obviously the part you're playing will be part of that conversation of trying to solve this stuff. And that's what I was saying, because I remember when I was a kid, they thought about trying to find the gene that might cause obesity, and they could turn it off.
Yeah.
And then we didn't ever have to worry about that again. I don't even know. Like, to me, that seems like science fiction. But there was a great movie called Gattaca.
Oh, yeah. I've heard
about it. About this whole, like, genetic engineering. And so, like, what we're talking about, genetic engineering and looking at the DNA, and this, of course, comes where CRISPR comes into play, where you can actually manipulate this stuff. Mm-hmm. So you're studying these tangles and the structure of it and watching the occurrences. You know, where does that lead? I mean, like, for your department, what's the end goal there? Just trying to learn more about it?
Yeah, so we're trying to figure out what proteins are necessary for these tangles to be untangled, because that plays a role in cancer. So if we can figure out which proteins, like which tools the cells are using, especially if there are differences between the way that healthy cells untangle these knots and cancerous cells untangle the knots, if there are differences in like a certain protein that's necessary, that could be a future cancer therapy, like inhibiting that protein. And so that's one thing that my lab has been working on. Before I got there, there's a protein called kappa that's very, so if you look at people with glioblastoma, if they have low stage or like healthy tissue, they don't make much, those cells don't make much kappa. But as you get from like stage one, stage two, stage three, stage four glioblastoma, they make even more of that protein. And so my lab was able to develop an inhibitor for that protein to stop it from working, because the idea is that that was leading to drug resistance in some glioblastomas, because chemotherapies damage the DNA. And so we study a group of repairing proteins that go back and repair. So it's like,
so you can maybe reverse the effects of cancer or reverse the effects of the chemo on the patient.
So the
damage, I mean.
Yes. So the, like if you have the tumor, we add chemo to try to damage the DNA of that tumor to the point that it will just die. it then produces these proteins to shield it.
Okay.
Or repair the damage that the chemo is doing. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to prevent it from fixing the damage.
So it can't heal itself in the middle of the chemo treatments and therefore it will die faster.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really, but it's super complex and that's why I love it. But
so we've talked about this before, like Cas4, isn't that a protein that's involved in the CRISPR?
I don't know of a Cas4. There's probably one because there's a Cas9.
Okay.
But Cas9 is the one that we use.
Okay. Let's pretend for a minute that I'm really dumb and I don't know what CRISPR is, because I don't know what CRISPR is and I'm kind of dumb.
It's an acronym that I don't know what it stands for.
Okay. The name of the acronym is like literally not helpful. It stands for Clustered Regularly Interspaced Palindromic Repeats.
That did not
help
me at
all.
So
now you know exactly what CRISPR is.
I know everything I need to know about CRISPR. So what is that for those of us who don't know what it's... I mean, I assume it's like gene altering? Yes.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So it's a way to change the DNA sequence. And so I was really interested in CRISPR in college just because it was kind of an up and coming, or it was an established experiment, but it was really new. And I think it was the most, there are a few other gene editing technologies, but CRISPR was the cheapest one and the most efficient one that I know of at the time. And so whenever I was accepted for the summer internship at this lab, Dr. Oaf was like, hey, I have a few project ideas. One is this, one is this, one is CRISPR. Which one do you want? And I was like, I want to do CRISPR. obviously, because I've been so interested in it. It's so cool. So I was working with another doctor, Lina Madukuri, who she just kind of did CRISPR and I did it alongside her. So back to your question, CRISPR it's originally from a bacterial immune system preventing viral infections. So what happens is, so bacteria can be infected by some viruses. And so a virus has a little copy of DNA or RNA, and what it'll do is it'll attach to the bacteria and just kind of like inject it in. And then that DNA will go into the bacteria and start making new viruses. And viruses do this because viruses cannot copy themselves. And so the bacteria, you know, it's using the bacterial resources. And so it's like, I'm not going to have that. I don't want to be infected. So this really cool immune system evolved in the bacteria that it has. So basically, if it gets infected by a virus, it will take a piece of that virus DNA or RNA and insert it into a CRISPR gene in the bacteria. And then this Cas9 enzyme protein can go take a piece of that and just look for that same DNA or RNA sequence. Does that make sense?
I've studied this a little bit, so I know what you're talking about. Mm-hmm, finding the match to...
Yeah, it's like taking a picture of it the first time it infects you, mm-hmm. and then carrying that picture. It's like a wanted poster. That's how I explain it a lot of things are like wanted posters in my in my brain. But so it's like the Cas9.
Be on the lookout for
Look out for this virus because it hurt you last time. So these two scientists, Jennifer Doudna and Emmanuel Chatelier, I think they were studying this system, and they were like, hey, this would be a cool tool to use in cells. This is just a good system. So they made this CRISPR system. And so I work with human cell culture. So I work with a couple of kidney cells. I work with some osteosarcoma, so bone cancer. And then sometimes I work with the brain cancer cells. And so what my summer project is, we use CRISPR to cut out the gene of the protein that we're interested in a cell line. Does that make sense?
So CRISPR is the actual technique of altering things?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
And I can explain more on works. So we wanted to, basically we wanted to see like, okay, if the cells don't have this tool, if the cells don't have this protein to fix those tangles, what else is happening? Do the tangles still get fixed? Maybe there's another player here. So we made, it's called a knockout cell line. So we use CRISPR to cut out the gene for the protein that we're studying. And so now those cells do not have...
So it's like process of elimination. Stop these proteins to see what else is going on.
Mm-hmm. So then we can do experiments. We can measure the number of, for example, tangles in the cells that do have that protein and then that have the knockout gene. Mm. So,
Is the ultimate goal to prevent cancer?
We're just trying
Is it possible to say we might be able to cure somebody with cancer as opposed to these other treatments that we've had in the past? I mean, is that, or either those logical goals, or, I mean, are they potential goals?
They're goals, but they would be 20 years out, probably.
Yeah, I didn't expect it today.
But CRISPR's,
by the end of the day, I want to be curing cancer.
The CRISPR's the technology. It's worldwide now in labs around the world.
Yeah, I didn't realize how common it was. Almost every lab has done it at some point now. It's so useful, and that's why those two scientists won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry 2020.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's such a useful tool.
What are the potential dangers in this?
Well, this
kind
is
of
where
research?
We get into like genetic engineering. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I know that it can be applied to like crops.
Yes.
Genetic
engineering
of food that could produce crops that could grow in places that it couldn't grow before, or a bigger, better food supply without fertilizers. I mean, there's a lot of stuff. I know the potential there.
Yeah.
But then you start talking about humans, and that's where it gets more controversial.
There are restrictions on this research for human cells. Yes or no?
Oh, for human cells?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I don't know. We've never tried to do anything.
Maybe that's not the right. I don't know enough about it to ask the right in the question. But so to genetically alter how someone is going to turn out, like to impact a human being,
right,
is still restricted. Yes.
Yeah.
At least in,
I would hope so.
I thought globally.
Yeah, we're not
doing
live testing yet on
humans. And I mean, that's the thing. Like, we do know some diseases where it's just one letter of the DNA, like cystic fibrosis. That's one letter of DNA that we could just fix.
You could do that in the embryonic stage and fix that?
Yes, but I think that's the issue. So if you do it in an adult person, it's not going to be passed down.
Oh, okay.
But the issue is with an adult getting the CRISPR technology to every cell in the body or all the cells you need to, for example, if there's I heard of a study, I haven't really looked into it though, so I'm going to be a little vague about it, but there was a group of people that had a toxic, their liver made some kind of, it was a misfolded protein. And so they were able to use CRISPR to eradicate that. So I think that CRISPR technology just needed to be delivered to the liver cells. But then what if it goes into your muscle cells and starts doing something? Like, there's an issue with understanding where exactly it goes, I think.
So we're still in the early stages of understanding the safety and how it could affect everything else.
Yeah, because it can have off-target effects. So that's one thing whenever we design. So one thing you have to do with CRISPR, the first step is you have to design the gene where you want to knock out. So this is just a website that we go to. We type in the protein that we want to knock out, and it just gives us a DNA sequence, or it gives us several different DNA sequences RNA sequences that we can use. It will give us, with each list of each RNA sequence we can use. Oh, I didn't mention, in CRISPR, it's the Cas9 enzyme, and then it has a guiding RNA attached to it that tells it where to go in the DNA. So, okay, backing up. So we can go to this website, and it will spit out a list of RNAs, and then it will also list how accurate those sequences are. Genes are potentially thousands of DNA bases, the letters long. So we only need to target, I think it's like 20 bases to get an accurate reading, but depending on where you are in that gene, it can change the product. It can change if it accidentally goes over here.
That's part of the reason why you're studying the unintended effects on a cell, like you were talking about a while ago. What else does it do? We need to know that before we start applying it.
Yeah.
What about the targeting of things like addiction? Those kind of things that can be passed down generation to generation. There's a propensity for, you know, not being a scientist. I don't know if that's true.
There's probably labs working on all the specific.
Yeah. So I wonder if there's a potential use of that to try to end someone's genetic cycle that might lead them to be more prone to addiction issues.
That's a good point. I would say though, so that if you wanted to edit it and have it passed down, I think that editing would have to take place in the embryo, and we have no idea how that would affect development. But also, I don't know that we fully understand the genes involved in addiction and how those genes are regulated. So I would be nervous to just say like, oh, we'll just knock out this gene if we don't fully understand
it. Well, yeah, sure. You don't want to randomly, you want to Frankenstein it.
We're kind of running out of time at this point. I do want to mention, is there any talk of AI contributing? I mean, you just mentioned computers.
Oh, and, yes.
Yeah, that's a good question.
Yes, there is. So the first thing I think of whenever you think about AI in my job is protein folding. So whenever the cells make a protein, you start with a DNA sequence, and then you make mRNA, and then that becomes a protein. But that protein is just a bunch of amino acids in a line. So you can think of it like a pearl necklace that's just like this. Yeah. But then that protein folds. And it's the same protein sequence, but we can't fully predict how they can fold. And I think last year, someone developed an AI software that was, I think it went from 40% to like 80% effective at predicting the structure of known proteins. So AI is a huge, I think it's, I think it's definitely involved in there, but that's a little bit more like biochemistry. But we still study protein structure. We're not, we don't really do too much with how the protein folds.
So there's a lot here. I mean, thanks for coming on the podcast and sharing your experience. Once again, students should now, at least you know research is an option. And there's the bell. But also, one thing that we, you know, want to make sure that we get across is doing your own research is probably not the best way to go. And this is one reason, hopefully, after listening to this.
There are professional researchers. Yeah. There is a way to do it and a way not to do it.
Right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we as history teachers, we you have to listen to experts. You know, there's people that spend years studying one battle of the Civil War. You know, what am I going to do Googling something in 5 minutes about this battle that, that this person hadn't came across?
Yeah.
So it is kind of, I hate the fact that it seems like in our society we have this attack on experts, but that's one of the things, reasons why I wanted you on, because is because I knew you'd say all this fancy stuff that I couldn't say.
And, it's not too fancy.
Well, for the lay person like me, that I still barely understand the words that are coming out of your mouth. And that's what, you know, that that is a good point to get across to people that are listening is this is our only option is to listen to people that
just because you watched 5 YouTube videos and read some things on Reddit doesn't make you an expert. Like there are years of really professionally trained people.
I know, you
to
just
do
said,
research.
I don't know much about this. I've only been doing it a year. And I'm like, yeah, go get you a year of research. I mean, that to me sounds like a long time to do something. And you're, because of what you do, you're like, I'm just now getting the hang of just one little thing.
And I think it's a really good, I feel like everyone should at least do research because it makes you feel really stupid all the time. And you really learn to be self-aware of how much you know and what you don't know. And so I try not to talk about the things that I don't really know. And I think everybody needs that because, you know, if people could get a taste of that, maybe there wouldn't be so much.
Well, I think we all have an obligation, though, to fight misinformation and disinformation. Mm-hmm. And for because there are people who are misled, who are intelligent in other ways. And I think that goes back to the COVID conversation. Mm-hmm. There were some really intelligent people who were stunningly ignorant during those moments, and that was on display. We've got to find a way to get back to trusting real experts, real research, real data.
Real science.
Real science. Yeah. Like we can't just live in this world of, well, my opinion is fact, you know. So so I appreciate you coming on and explaining that, too.
Like that's
I think
so
that should be super helpful, especially for, and we do have a, you know, a large and growing listenership. And so maybe that'll help positively lead somebody else towards a path of better understanding. So,
yeah, I will say, I think that initially there were issues in the COVID communication because people didn't understand that science is supposed to change over time. And if they do one test or, you know, if they do, like me, 15 experiments and they find this and then they think of a way to ask the question differently and then they find other data that contradicts what they did, that doesn't mean they were wrong initially and it doesn't mean that they were lying initially.
Right.
It just means they learned something new and now we're all better and we have a better idea of reality. And I think if people understood that about science...
Yeah, the virus wasn't waiting on us to figure it out before it spread. So they were giving us the best information they had at the time.
Yeah.
So, I can definitely see that. Well,
something you said on one of the videos that I caught early was that science self... It wasn't... what's the phrase? It was self-regulates or it self-corrects? Science self-corrects.
Mm-hmm.
And it should have the opportunity to do that.
Yes.
Like, well, this is the way it's always going to be. Mm-hmm. Like, no, that's... it. Can and probably will change when you learn more.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, that's a great point. People need to understand that.
Yeah. And I wish if I can also just promote scientists a little bit. Scientists are so skeptical. Scientists will argue over every little detail because they care about that detail. So for people to be like, oh, scientists are stupid or, you know,
arrogant, which is about the last thing you see, because if you listen to a scientific conference, before they speak, it's like, well, I'm sure there's somebody here that knows more about this than me, but here's my little tiny narrow knowledge of this. And the last thing you see is really arrogance, because they're all worried about being proven wrong. And when they when real scientists aren't sure of something, they won't talk about that.
But that's what a real discipline will do to itself. Right. Like, you want to weed out the weak arguments, and people you should have it tested over and over again. So does this does it continue to hold water now that we have these other? I mean, we try to do that in history as best we can. All this, a little bit more subjective with us. Science can be more concrete, but that doesn't mean that it's finite. You continue to learn and uncover new truth that you need to apply to the system. That's what the testing is all about, I assume.
Yeah, exactly.
And of course, we deal with politics, which is the opposite of science. It's saying things confidently that you don't even know about because you're trying to spread this message. So it is funny how scientists are being attacked by politicians.
Well, I think that means a lot. I think that that means politicians know that they're not inherently logical. And scientists see that very quickly. And that it's dangerous to politicians who don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
That's why I wish we would have more scientists in politics.
Hey.
You get problem solvers in there.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And that is another edition of History After Hours. Goodbye.